over the past few decades, there has been a decline in dealmakers and a rise in ideologues.
The thorny divide over the state's budget gap. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski gets recognized for her support of the arts.
When you think about our day-to-day world, our culture, the things that we celebrate, the things that we identify with, arts are so much a part of what it is that we do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The U.S. Senate today has voted to overturn an Obama administration rule that restricted certain methods of killing predators on national wildlife refuges in Alaska. The vote was 52-47. The Obama administration wanted to ban killing bear cubs and wolves in their dens, killing bears over bait, and other practices that opponents deem inhumane. The methods aren't broadly allowed in Alaska anyway, but the state game board says they're tools that it should be able to deploy when needed to restore a balance between predator and prey species. Alaska's congressional delegation argued the state has the right to manage hunting throughout Alaska and that the rule violated the statehood compact and other federal laws. The House has already voted to overturn the regulation. President Trump is expected to sign the repeal. An identical Park Service regulation remains on the books related to hunting on Alaska's national preserves. Friday was the two-thirds mark of the annual 90-day legislative session. Philosophical differences between members of the House and Senate are raising the risk that the legislature ends the session without resolving the state's ongoing budget crisis. But fiscal experts maintain some optimism that lawmakers will be able to bridge the divide. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Both legislative chambers have proposed cuts to the budget. The House passed a budget Monday that cuts $32 million from this year's state budget, and the Senate is currently weighing $184 million in cuts, in addition to up to $60 million in cuts to education. But neither side's cuts would put much of a dent in the nearly $3 billion gap between what the state spends and what it raises in oil royalties, taxes, and fees. To close that gap, most lawmakers and policy experts agree that the state must draw from permanent fund earnings to shore up the budget for the first time. Most proposals would also reduce permanent fund dividends. But differences between the mostly Democratic House majority and the mostly Republican Senate majority are proving to be a stumbling block to a deal. That's according to Cliff Groh. He's the chairman of the nonpartisan policy organization Alaska Common Ground.
In the Alaska State Legislature, as in Congress, and generally around the United States of America, over the past few decades, there has been a decline in dealmakers and a rise in ideologues.
The House majority wants to package a draw from permanent fund earnings with an income tax, while the Senate wants deeper cuts to the budget first. The Senate passed its permanent fund bill while the House is still discussing its bill. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki pointed to a projection from the nonpartisan Legislative Finance Division that found the Senate bill would close 95% of the gap in 6 years if the state kept spending flat. Reducing oil tax credits may be more likely to become law than an income tax. Michicki says oil revenue from newly discovered oil could also help close the budget gap.
If we get an uptick of a few dollars on the price of oil or one of those fields come online, we're balanced. And the Senate is willing to talk about other legislation that will help in that way as well. But if we don't see what we need to see coming across the finish line from the House, we have legislation waiting that will be heading the other way.
House members say the focus on spending reductions has begun to threaten the state's economy. Nome Democrat Neil Foster says deep cuts over the past 3 years make it more difficult to find more reductions.
The question is, how deeply do we want to continue to make cuts? And, you know, I think that at this point we've cut a lot of the fat out. There's not a lot of room left. Further cuts will be, you know, I think cuts to the bone.
Senate leaders don't want an income tax to be part of the permanent fund bill. They say combining them could violate legislative rules that require bills to be on a single subject. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon has qualms with the House approach.
We have a lot of folks in new positions that are, from my perspective, trying political maneuvers that they believe can accomplish what they want, but over the course of time, at least how I've worked, is the less cute stuff that you're trying to do, the less political maneuvering, the better it is for clarity for everybody.
On the House side, Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton rejects the argument. He notes that legal experts have already okayed the House bill. But Seaton says the House will look to areas like oil taxes if the Senate won't budge.
It's a little disappointing listening to the Senate talk about not really wanting to consider a broad-based tax, an income tax. And so we might have to be looking at increasing the tax rates there somewhat over what the Resources Committee did.
One person who is optimistic about progress this session is Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck. As Governor Bill Walker's point person with the legislature on finding a fiscal solution, Hoffbeck is encouraged.
The most positive thing is that there isn't any real debate anymore about using permanent fund earnings as part of the solution. I think everybody pretty much agrees that has to occur. And it's really just a matter of how.
Hoffbeck says getting 95% of the way there only through changes to the permanent fund isn't enough. But while Walker wants a plan that has a balanced effect on Alaskans of different incomes, Hoffbeck says reaching a sustainable plan is most critical.
I think the key is going to be a fiscal plan that works. Certainly balance is important, but I don't think it's going to be the absolute that needs to be met. You know, for instance, if somebody decided to substitute a sales tax for an income tax, I think some people will argue that's not as balanced, and it wouldn't be. But if it gets us to a full fiscal solution, I think that would be acceptable.
Cliff Gross says a combination of public pressure, Walker's involvement, and the desire from some legislative leaders to make a deal could help bridge the remaining divide. But next year's election makes the political calculations difficult.
The closer we get to the gubernatorial election, the more you're going to have more posturing and maneuvering that is based on political calculations for people's personal advantages.
The Senate Finance Committee is discussing the budget this week, while the House Finance Committee is focusing on the oil and gas tax credit bill. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
President Trump's budget outline calls for eliminating funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. The NEA has been a frequent target of Republicans, but today a national arts group gave U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski an award, citing her support for the NEA. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Americans for the Arts gave Murkowski its 2017 Congressional Arts Leadership Award. In a press release, the group said Murkowski has consistently supported fair and reasonable funding levels for the NEA. The Alaska Republican says her position isn't related to her party affiliation.
When you think about our day-to-day world, our culture, the things that we celebrate, the things that we identify with, arts are so much a part of what it is that that we do.
Last year, the government spent nearly $150 million on the NEA. Alaska received about $1 million of that in grants, primarily to the State Council on the Arts. How much it receives this year will depend, as always, on Congress. And Murkowski chairs the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees endowment funding. She spoke to reporters on her way into the Senate chamber in an ornate lobby coated in Rococo portraits and frescoes. She cited art exposure for children and a new therapeutic arts program for military members at J-Bear among the reasons to support the arts and culture.
So whether it's our Alaska Native leaders and how they are building on their initiatives, or whether it's the arts that you see in a building like we're standing in now.
So worthy of government support?
I believe so.
Government money for the NEA has plunged since the 1990s when Republicans railed against some controversial exhibits. Back then, Alaska Congressman Don Young took particular issue with the support for Robert Mapplethorpe photographs. But in its annual report card on Congress, Americans for the Arts gave Congressman Young a thumbs up last year, in part for putting his name to letters supporting arts funding. As for Senator Dan Sullivan, he didn't get the thumbs up, but the arts group liked that he voted for an education bill. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a sports permit in Thompson Pass angers local residents.
My reaction was devastated. The state has decided to reward their failure.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Governor Bill Walker has signed into law legislation allowing state health officials to extend a program for broader distribution of a drug used to prevent opioid overdose. Last month, in declaring rampant opioid abuse a public health disaster, Walker proposed spending about $4.1 million in federal grants for distribution of naloxone. The drug can be used to prevent overdose. He initially requested that his declaration be extended to February 2018, but lawmakers instead passed legislation permitting a standing medical order for the naloxone program through June 2021. The measure also calls for reports on efforts to fight opioid abuse. Walker says this is the first bill he's signed this session, and in a statement, thanked legislators for helping prioritize the issue. An outside consultant has concluded that Sitka's two hospitals should merge. Those are the findings of ECG Management Consultants, a firm hired by Sitka Community Hospital and Search last year. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Healthcare is the topic tonight at a special meeting of the Sitka Assembly. They'll dive into ECG's report on the future of Sitka's two hospitals. The 27-page PowerPoint recommends that Search purchase Sitka Community Hospital's assets and absorb all of its healthcare operations. The two hospitals have been conversing for months about ways to collaborate. Sitka Community Hospital was interested in a joint venture where the two medical providers would work as a team. But talks fell apart in January. Here's Sitka Community Hospital CEO Rob Allen.
We couldn't reach consensus. Leadership on the other side, that was not something that they saw as made sense.
The other side being Search, which operates Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. ECG's Kevin Kennedy, the lead consultant, has concluded that a joint venture is too costly, requiring $20 million in startup capital alone, and that a merger is a win-win for the community.
If Sitka Community does decide to join Search and to come together with them, it not only pays for itself, but it produces so much extra revenue that can be channeled into the health needs of the community.
Like hiring a full-time cardiologist and doing away with duplicate services. There are two emergency rooms in Sitka. The report also concludes that while Sitka Community Hospital has stabilized its cash flow, there are some dark clouds on the financial horizon. A negative balance sheet, an expensive electronic medical record system, and deferred capital needs. Here's Kennedy.
The average age of capital at that facility is well above what we see with other hospitals, and it's going to be some really big checks to write. And it's going to be up to the assembly to decide whether they want to write those checks to try to maintain two hospitals in a city that really most people acknowledge should really only have one.
Allen disagrees. In the past 2 years, he's helped bring the hospital back into financial solvency and has no plans to shut down.
We're moving it forward like this is not happening and figuring out what we need to do to be sustainable and to respond to the competition and to be successful.
The hospital recently had a visioning session. Some top goals are to implement a cheaper electronic medical record system, that's more responsive to changes in Medicare and Medicaid and scaling down operations.
We need to be the right size, providing the right services, and that's what our focus is going to be on the next year, is getting to that point.
As for the report, Allen calls it overly pessimistic about the hospital's financial future.
I don't think our future is quite as dire as that we have some options that we're working on, different ways to become more resilient and able to respond to, you know, a lot of uncertainty.
The decision about what to do next, explore the merger option, maintain the status quo, or something else, rests in the hands of the SICA Assembly. But for Kennedy, the answer is clear. Should a merger take place, search plans to retain all employees and give SickKins a role in governance.
So I really hope that the Assembly decides to avail themselves of that, because that's really the sort of thing that only comes around once in a generation.
Search, which operates 18 facilities throughout the state, has not made a formal offer to acquire SICA Community Hospital. Search CEO Charles Clement was traveling and could not be reached for comment for this story. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Cleanup has resumed along a stretch of the Richardson Highway near Paxson, where more than 4,000 gallons of diesel was spilled when a Fairbanks-based tanker wrecked in January. But as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it may take years to clean up all the contamination.
About 4,300 gallons of diesel spilled when the Colville Transport double tanker truck hit the ditch back on January 9th near milepost 164 of the Richardson Highway, about 20 miles south of Paxson. Colville and its cleanup contractors began work on the spill, but soon realized they'd be unable to remove all of the contaminated material because the fuel had soaked into the roadbed on which the highway was built.
The release that occurred at milepost 164 is specifically complicated because it did run under the roadway. And short of digging up the Richardson Highway, then there's going to be contamination mass that's left behind.
Ashley Adamczak is an environmental program specialist with the State Department of Environmental Conservation Office in Fairbanks. She says DEC officials are overseeing the resumption of the cleanup, and she says the agency, along with Colville and its contractors, are working with the Federal Bureau of Land Management, which administers the land outside of the highway right-of-way, to figure out how to remove as much contaminated material as possible without creating additional problems.
What's the slope at the excavation that we can do without causing a potential safety hazard for the Richardson Highway stabilization? How much vegetation can we remove from the surface, and how far out can we go and disturb that area for the landowners?
Adamczak says DEC, along with Colville and its contractors, have also been coordinating with the State Department of Transportation on cleaning up the contamination. She says officials with the two agencies also are talking about completing the cleanup when the Transportation Department rebuilds that section of the highway, as it's been doing on some of the worst stretches of the road over the past several years.
When they do rebuild the section of the road, what can we kind of anticipate on the front end to get ready for that removal of soil when they do rebuild the road?
Transportation Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey confirms there have been discussions with DEC on the cleanup and its complications.
We recognize that there is an issue there, and we're trying to design some solutions or some mitigation.
Bailey says the department's list of projects does include one calling for reconstruction of the Richardson from milepost 159 to 167.
The Rich 159 through 167 is currently in design. There are additional Richardson Highway projects that are also in the design phase. That said, though, construction probably is several years out, and there currently is not funding identified for construction.
Adamczak says Colville and its contractors are expected to remove some 1,300 cubic yards of soil and vegetation from areas alongside the highway before breakup, if possible. That's more than 50 truckloads with a semi-tractor-pulled dump trailer. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
A big winter sports event kicked off over the weekend in Thompson Pass. Tailgate Alaska is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but not everyone is in a joyful mood. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, some Thompson Pass enthusiasts are not happy after the Alaska Department of Natural Resources granted a land use permit to event organizers. They hope to appeal the decision.
For 10 days each spring, skiers and riders from around the globe gather for Tailgate Alaska, to learn how to safely live out the excitement and adventure of real-life freeriding. Here, it is all about the access.
When you go to the Tailgate Alaska website, this is the first video you will see. If you click on the link about tickets, you will find another video of Tailgate Alaska founder Mark Sullivan telling you what activities come with a ticket.
Safety. We have an 8-man rescue team who are on call at all hours of daylight to basically scrape you out of the mountains if you do make a mistake while accessing the terrain here at Tailgate. The third thing is entertainment.
It also includes the amenities.
Things like Wi-Fi, garbage service, and porta-johns right here in the middle of the backcountry on Thompson Pass.
In its 10 years of existence, the festival, known for its skiing, snowboarding, and other winter sports, has been criticized by residents in nearby Valdez. Those concerns grew after the Division of Mining, Land, and Water of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources recently granted a 4-year land use permit to Tailgate Alaska organizers.
My reaction was devastated. The state has decided to reward their failure.
Lisa Wax is a longtime Thompson Pass enthusiast and has been involved with events in the area like the World Extreme Skiing Championships from the 90s. Like most of Tailgate's critics, she says she has concerns about the event's lack of a safety plan.
Skiers might be skiing up a mountain and one of these people that just doesn't have the experience gets on a snow machine and starts cutting up above them and just doesn't have the background of avalanche safety, oftentimes never been on a snow machine or in the backcountry at all.
Other concerns include environmental impacts on the area and the lack of economic impact on Valdez. Now, Wax and others are appealing the permit.
You know, they're staying 30 miles outside of Valdez. They come in with their trailers and campers all packed. You know, they're bringing in their food and their fuel. And as several folks indicated in the comments, they have very little interest in Valdez and only use the town on an absolute desperate basis.
The permit allows organizers to hold the event for 10 days between March 15th and April 15th near Worthington Glacier on Thompson Pass. They can allow an unlimited number of people into the festival. They are responsible for snow removal, creating parking spaces, and setting up and cleaning up the area after they are done.
The general public that comes to recreate and hang out in the area, that's kind of no different than anywhere else in Alaska, is you're responsible for your own actions.
Clark Cox is the South Central Regional Manager of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. He says DNR gets complaints about events like Tailgate Alaska all the time, even though they are not responsible for what goes on within them.
In a lot of ways, we rely on those folks to kind of be the eyes and the ears. We can't possibly be in every remote location where we issue every easement, every permit, every lease. So that's where someone letting us know what they've seen, take some pictures, document it, send it to us, and let us do our evaluation on this side with that permit or lease or easement holder. That's how the system works.
Wax and others have 20 days from the time that the permit was issued to submit comments to DNR Commissioner Andrew Mack. If the appeal is successful, the permit will be revoked. KCHU attempted to contact Tailgate Alaska founder Mark Sullivan about the permit issue via phone, but was unable to leave a message due to the voicemail box being full. An email message was sent to an address posted on the Tailgate Alaska Facebook page, but was not returned in time for the story. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The totem pole is an icon of the Pacific Northwest. The carved art form showcases clan stories and family crests and is often in museums around the world. After more than 30 years in the Anchorage Museum, a century-old pole from Southeast has made it back to Sitka. KCAW's Emily Russell has the story.
I'm standing inside Totem Hall at Sitka National Historical Park. It's a little echoey in here. That's because the ceilings, they're about 30 feet high. Sun is streaming through the windows, but it's cold in here.
The environment in here really mirrors the outside environment. We do not have any heat or humidification going on in this part of the facility.
That's the park's museum curator, Kelsey Lutz. She oversees the park's collection of more than 30 totem poles. Most of them are outside along the park's trail system. The oldest ones, though, are stored here inside Totem Hall.
They are used to being outside in that kind of wet environment and kind of a cool environment. So this is really perfect for the wood.
Poles tower over us, so tall you have to crane your neck to see the tops of them. There is one, though, that you actually have to look down to see. Lutz invites me back to take a look.
Yeah, feel free to come in here.
It's got some traffic cones.
A couple of bright orange traffic cones work as dividers between the pole and museum patrons. Behind them lies a totem pole in two sections.
So the Raven Shark pole that has come back is the original pole.
That's Angie Richman. She's the chief of interpretation at the park. The Raven Shark pole at our feet was carved in Kloak over 100 years ago. Richman says it was donated to Alaska's governor at the time.
So just a year after it was donated, it went to St. Louis for the 1904 Louisiana Purchase Exposition, so also known as the World's Fair.
It was also shown at the World's Fair in Oregon in 1905, brought back to Sitka for a few decades, and then went back out on the road for the New York World's Fair in 1964.
And in 1978, due to just the deterioration, that was when it was taken off the trail and moved inside.
And it's been inside ever since, most recently in the atrium of the Anchorage Museum, where the pole stood on display for 30 years. In the late 70s, when the original pole was moved inside, a replica of the Raven Shark pole was carved and folded into the forest along Totem Trail here in Sitka.
The trail loops around the coastline, and sometimes there's a break in the trees like there is here where the Raven Shark replica pole stands. You can see out on the ocean, and it's just spectacular.
Wet snow is falling and forming puddles on the trail today. I'm here with Tommy Joseph. He's a Tlingit wood carver originally from Ketchikan.
My first opportunity to work with a knife on a piece of wood was in the third grade, 8 years old.
Since then, Joseph says he's carved 40 or so full-size totem poles. He stopped counting after 30.
Totem poles, well, they're a visual tool for telling a story, somebody's story about who they are, where they're from, what they're all about. Some are grave markers or mortuary memorial poles.
Others are commemorative, like the centennial pole Joseph carved for Sitka National Historical Park's 100th anniversary. But as Joseph says, they all tell stories. The Raven Sharks is one of two clans coming together. That's the Raven and the Shark clans. Since its carving over a century ago, the pole has told that story to onlookers around the country. But curator Kelsey Lutz says this will be its final home. It could be a few months before the pole stands upright in Totem Hall. Until then, Lutz says they'll focus on the pole's presentation.
Well, hopefully we'll upgrade the traffic cones to something more museum appropriate.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Kwong and Emily Russell in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.